The Tom Woods Show, episode 472.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. You know what I love? Getting paid for things I'm going to do anyway. So I just joined Ebates because I get cash back for purchases I'm going to make anyway. Sign up through tomwoods.com/Ebates and get a free $10 gift card. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Talking today about energy, and in particular about wind and solar power. This is back in the news because of Bernie Sanders, who thinks we need to spend more money on developing wind and solar power, and we should tax carbon emissions and so on and so forth. So we're going to hash that out. We've talked about that, I don't know, probably like 187 episodes ago. That's not an exaggeration. It probably was about 187 episodes ago. But I want to talk to Rob Bradley. We've never spoken to him on the show before. Rob Bradley is the CEO and founder of the Institute for Energy Research. He is the author of 7 books, most recently Edison to Enron, Energy Markets and Political Strategies. He's also the author of Energy, the Master Resource, which is the inspiration for the leading free market energy blog, masterresource.org. And for listeners of this show, perhaps the most interesting thing about Rob Bradley is that the chairman of his PhD dissertation committee was none other than Murray Rothbard. Rob Bradley, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Tom.
I've been talking to Bob Murphy quite a bit lately about show ideas, and I said I want to talk about Bernie Sanders proposals, and one of them has to do with energy and throwing more federal money at wind power and solar power and so on and so forth is one of his proposals, as is a tax on carbon emissions and so on. I mean, very conventional leftist approach to energy, really, but all the same, very important to respond to that. So he said, yeah, I don't think you've ever had Rob Bradley on your show. I've done over 470 episodes. I've never had you on. So I thought this is the perfect topic to talk about. It's not directly in the news this particular second. So it's not like there's an urgent news hook, but I think Bernie Sanders is an urgent news hook. So let's start with what seems plausible to the average person, that maybe given the side effects of fossil fuels, it would be better if we could devote more resources to things like wind power and solar power that seem to have no such unpleasant consequences and can generate clean energy for us on a renewable basis. What's wrong with that kind of thinking?
Well, to use an old term that Murray Rothbard used to use, it is a tissue of fallacies, but it has some superficial appeal. Like a lot of planning ideas, you think of wind and solar, you think of free energy. We don't pay to have the wind blow or the sunshine. But the problem is that these are very dilute forms of energy that come in a very dilute flow compared to fossil fuels, which is very concentrated energy from the sun's work over many millions of years. So to take wind and natural wind and solar and to turn it into a usable product, and we're talking about electricity here, requires huge amounts of capital investment, which translates into a lot of steel, a lot of concrete, a lot of land space or roof space, and it ends up being very expensive. So the socialist idea of really the central planning idea of let's transform energy markets, fossil fuels are bad, into this perceived nirvana of natural renewable energy is quite fallacious. And as a matter of fact, it probably has more negative environmental consequences than using a very dense, storable energy such as natural gas, coal, and oil.
All right, let's develop that further. How could that be when we can, everybody knows the pollution that is caused by burning coal, for example, how could there be anything to compare with that in these other forms of energy?
Well, let's focus on coal, which is the least clean of the three fossil fuels under current technology to generate electricity. You look at emissions from a state-of-the-art coal plant today, and there's extensive regulations today on coal emissions versus the coal plants of several decades ago, let's say early 70s back. And coal is a reformulated, much cleaner form of energy. So control coal plants are much cleaner than uncontrolled coal plants. It's not unlike gasoline itself, which has been reformulated and is very much an environmental product today compared to uncontrolled levels through the 60s. So coal has gotten a lot cleaner. And with technological advances, it will become cleaner still. Now, there's one emission that is not a pollutant, even though the Supreme Court decided 5-4 some years ago that it was and was subject to the Clean Air Act, and that is carbon dioxide, CO2.
All right, let's come back to the CO2 in a minute because I want to treat that separately. I've heard some numbers. I don't expect you to know them off the top of your head, but I know that there are numbers out there that would put in very stark contrast the amount of energy that I can get from solar panels or from wind turbines or whatever as compared to some amount of a fossil fuel, so that it shows as soon as you hear the statistic, you automatically – it becomes absolutely clear – that there is no competition between these sources whatsoever, and it would be impossible, inconceivable to think of replacing fossil fuels on any serious scale with these other forms of energy. What can you tell us about that? I mean, in other words, the case is ridiculous.
Yeah. When you look at the facts of the amount of kilowatt hours produced by renewables or non-hydro renewables, versus fossil fuels, you see a stark difference in the footprint. The amount of land, the amount of steel, concrete, and all the rest of it. And interestingly, this was first noticed in a 1865 book by William Stanley Jevons, a very prominent intellectual of the time, called The Coal Question. And he made the link between industrialization and dense energy, i.e. fossil fuels. And he very clearly, renewable by renewable, explained why there was no going back. And let's say with primitive biomass, the burning of a plant in woody matter, which was the number one source of energy other than fossil fuels in his day, that would require a tremendous amount of land. It would cover the whole island of England, the UK, with plants and trees. So the environmental angle is very interesting here, and that is, the fossil fuels, what you're doing is you're digging deep into the earth. But if you don't want to do that, then you're having to use a whole lot of the earth's surface, the green area, to get your energy. And it's exactly what you don't want to do from an ecological perspective.
All right, so let's go to the carbon dioxide thing and talk about this question. Now, if you talk about climate change and you are a skeptic, you know what's going to happen to you. you're going to be laughed out of court, you're not entitled to an opinion, and that famous 97% figure is going to be thrown in your face. Now, don't you know 97% of climate scientists disagree with you? That 97% figure, from what I've seen, is David Friedman wrote something on it that was absolutely devastating. There's nothing to that 97% figure. It, as usual with the left, their statistics are all phony, whether it's, 50 million American children are starving to death or whatever. They throw these figures out all the time. 3-4 million people are homeless. There's no basis for that. They just made that figure up. Or 150,000 women are dying every year from anorexia when it's like 85 people total. They make stuff up constantly, and I understand this 97% thing is just in that hallowed tradition of making up figures to try to intimidate people into silence.
Yes, well, we have a consensus today, an alleged consensus on climate change, and one of the arguments I use against it was we had a very similar consensus that socialism and central planning was the way to have an efficient economy for several decades in academia. And you might know this better than me, but it might have been as late as the 1970s, let's say, when Paul Samuelson, in his economics textbook, the number one textbook in the country, I think it was 1989, he finally came out and said, well, no, but, or he did say in that textbook that the Russian economy was just fine. So it takes, sometimes you have the intellectual class that is dead wrong. But regarding the 97%, as climatologist Roy Spencer has noted, he's a member of the 97%, and I would be a member too, because I think most scientists virtually all believe, I guess that's your 97%, that CO2 has an enhanced greenhouse effect, but that does not mean that there's a negative externality with increasing atmospheric concentrations of CO2. Moderately warmer and wetter and CO2 fertilization might result in CO2 emissions being a net positive externality. I don't think there's any intellectual in the world that can answer that question, whether CO2 is a positive or negative externality. And maybe it's a question that can't be answered in the sense that there's so many positives and negatives and you can't compare them between people and places. But what we do know is that government intervention in the name of correcting this alleged negative externality is all pain and no gain. And the idea of a social cost of carbon and the case for a carbon tax or regulation or cap and trade is very intellectually weak. And Robert Murphy, who you mentioned, has done great work on the social cost of carbon in talking about how a carbon tax is a leisure.
Yeah, I will link to that on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/472. I'll ask Bob what's his best piece on that. But let's say, for the sake of argument, let's say that the global warming climate change people are correct, that this is happening, there is warming, it is being caused primarily by human activity. Let's say they're right about that.
I agree with all that. I agree with all that so far.
So what would be the harm? What exactly is the nature of the harm in saying we need to do something to halt this, and the something that we can do is forcibly limiting the amount of these emissions?
Well, the next step is that, you know, it's bad. Something can be bad, but it doesn't mean you are going to turn to government for a solution. Theoretically, there's market failure, but practically, you know, there's government failure too. So the problem has to be so pronounced and so definable that government interventions can be effective. And that's a huge problem because CO2 is a global issue. There's a global common, so to speak, with CO2 emissions and increasing atmospheric concentrations of CO2. So, the idea that government can come in and correct this is where things become ludicrous. And even the theoretical attempts to justify it, they have to assume perfect knowledge, in the sense that the knowledge is perfectly understood, the solutions are understood, and you have, quote, an environmental pope, a global environmental pope, to implement the solutions. So the only way you can make an intellectual case for this is to use a set of assumptions that just don't apply in the real world. So, you know, maybe, you know, in an ivory tower, you can come up with a case for government intervention in the name of correcting the negative externality of CO2 emissions. But, you know, you just cannot translate that into or take it to Washington, D.C. or a state capital or any government capital.
Let me play devil's advocate here. I could imagine an opponent saying, well, we certainly did that with regular old air pollution. We came up with a command and control way of approaching that, and the result has been not perfect. It's certainly got a lot of dead weight loss in it. It hasn't been without its costs, but the results are for everyone to see. We have much cleaner air, much cleaner water. Why can't we do with carbon emissions what we did for air and water?
That's a good question. I think the most fundamental answer or critique of that is that carbon dioxide is not like lead and sulfur dioxide and particulate matter and the criteria of pollutants. It's something that's completely different. That's why if you understand the wording and the intention of the Clean Air Act, CO2 was not among the pollutants. So that's the most important thing. They're trying to define a non-pollutant as a pollutant because of indirect effects that it has. But what really messes everything up from the central planners' point of view with CO2 control is that it's a global issue and not a regional or local. It's a global emission and not a local regional emission. So let's say one country can have very stringent regulation on CO2. Well, another country might not. And as a matter of fact, there might be so-called leakage where industry from the highly regulated area moves to the unregulated area and CO2 emissions actually go up. Because in the unregulated area, the pollution controls are less than that.
So that's an argument for world government. That would be an argument for world government from the left's point of view.
Yes, you really need a global government. But then again, this global government, how well are they going to be able to enforce a global regulation? And again, we're not dealing with a pollutant in the classic sense.
Rob, let's pause for just a minute for this message. Hey, everybody, if you're like me, you do a lot of shopping online, and you also like free money. Well, combine those two together, and you get Ebates. Join it through tomwoods.com/Ebates, and you get cash back through over 1,800 retailers. So that means every time you shop online at Target or Walmart or Lowe's or Home Depot or JCPenney or Groupon or Best Buy or Overstock.com or Dell or Nike or Nordstrom or all these other retailers, you get cash back just for existing. Now, don't use it for Amazon. For Amazon, you're going to enter Amazon through tomwoods.com/Amazon to help keep the lights on here at the Tom Woods Show. But for the other 1,799 retailers, claim your cash back. And to sweeten the deal, sign up through tomwoods.com/Ebates and get a free $10 gift card. This is money you're leaving on the table. Get out there and grab it. tomwoods.com/Ebates. Let me ask you an unrelated question, just because I think it's of interest to the audience. a lot of my audience wants to, you know, abolish federal agencies left and right. In fact, I would say the whole audience. The Department of Energy sometimes is listed as one of the departments that a libertarian could live without. But can you explain what the Department of Energy does or what it's supposed to do and how we would live in its absence?
Well, I think we'd live very well as consumers and taxpayers in its absence. Yes, I guess through the Reagan administration, there was a lot of talk about abolishing the Department of Energy. And it's something that should be done, but there's some functions of the department that would be transferred to other agencies, such as military-related activities that deal with energy. But the core of the department is with things that can be privatized, such as the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, where you can bring in some money and get these get some valuable assets to the private sector, sort of a double win. But there's a whole lot of activity that DOE is doing with renewable energy and the national labs that are just pure propaganda machines for the wind and solar industries, and those are easy budget cuts. Maybe the last thing you would eliminate from the Department of Energy, and by the last, I mean I'd give it maybe a few more weeks, would be the Energy Information Administration, which compiles a lot of useful statistics and has actually done some pretty good work on energy reality, and has been a natural pushback to some of the very unrealistic renewable energy schemes that have come out of the political process. But the short answer is, yes, we can eliminate the Department of Energy. Some functions would be transferred regarding national defense, but everything else can go. We'd free up a lot of resources for the productive side of the economy.
Well, one final thing. You mentioned the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I've never read anything about it. My understanding is that this is an innovation following the oil crisis of the 1970s, and the thought was, we'll keep some oil off the market for an emergency in case we're ever in a vice like this ever again and we need energy supplies. We'll have some that have been kept off the market that'll be available. Now, of course, the amount in reserve is so trivial that it wouldn't really make a big difference anyway. But is your response to this idea that we already have something that rations energy supplies? It's called the price system.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. The reserve holds 700 million barrels of oil, and what makes it useful in a supply emergency, at least theoretically, is that the withdrawal can be, you know, 3 to 4 million barrels a day. So if there's a major cutoff, then you could supply this for, 60, 90 days. I'd have to do the math. Theoretically, that's the rationale. Now, if you look at everything else, you realize that this is just another classic example of the unintended consequences of government intervention or the very predictable consequences. You look at the average cost of a barrel of oil in the reserve, where you take the acquisition costs and add in all the storage maintenance costs and adjust it for inflation, you might have $150 or $200 barrel oil in there. There was a lot of buying high. They've had a few sales, but when do you sell this stuff? That's another central planning question. But basically, the reserve came after the first two oil crises, where we were actually in the gasoline lines, and the reserve was intended for the third great oil shock, and that never happened. And the unlearned lesson of the energy crisis, at least from the central planner's point of view, SPR point of view, is that price and allocation controls are what create the gasoline lines and energy crises, and not the free market. So the SPR was always a central planning tool. And a lot of us never liked it because we thought that this would give government an excuse to impose price controls in some sort of an emergency, just to say, oh, we have the reserve, and if we overshoot, then we'll just withdraw from the reserve. So there's all sorts of good reasons to liquidate the reserve and reduce the potential power of the federal government over the oil market.
Rob, if people want to follow your work and to find out about a free market approach to energy in general, where would you send them online?
There's a blog that I administer, and we have a number of different authors. We've had more than 150, as a matter of fact, different free market voices on energy issues at a website called masterresource.org. Master resource being a term that Julian Simon used for energy. And we're very much inspired by the Julian Simon worldview, but we had a libertarian slant. So I think there's a lot of good information there. If there's some energy issue that you're interested in, Google the energy term and master resource, and I think something useful will come up.
Very good. Well, Rob Bradley, I appreciate your time today. I'm going to direct people to the website you mentioned, masterresource.org, and we'll have a couple of other items of interest, including an article of yours on free market energy policy over at tomwoods.com/472. Thanks so much again.
Great. Good being with you, Tom.
All right, everybody. Remember the resources on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/472. I can't remember if I told you guys, but we're just about to add course number 14 over at libertyclassroom.com. This is by our old friend Brad Berzer, the guy I bring on to talk about music half the time. And we have a great old time, and I don't know if anybody enjoys it or not, but we sure do. But anyway, Brad is a really, really smart guy, and he's produced a nice course for us called Trails West, How Freedom Settled the West. I'll have a sample of that up fairly soon. We got to get it up on the site. It'll be up relatively soon. But 14 courses, and it's still for the same price it was back when we launched it in early 2012 with only 4 courses. I mean, what am I, crazy? So I just don't raise prices. Now, by the way, I actually am going to be raising the price, but that's another matter. The point is, course number 14 is up there. You're crazy if you're not yet a member. If you join the Supporting Listeners program at supportinglisteners.com, you get a that sounds like a bad thing, doesn't it? Let's say a serious discount, big-time discount at Liberty Classroom. But anyway, libertyclassroom.com is the site. Check that out. I guess I'll have to book Brad to come on and talk a little bit about this subject. That'll be interesting. We will try to stay off the subject of music. We'll talk about that after we've been on the air. Tomorrow we're going to talk about labor markets and unemployment and is Obama a good jobs president and all that. We're going to sort out all the numbers and what's really going on tomorrow. So thanks for listening, everybody. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.